This is a story called Just Another Day by Hud. You know that's bullshit, right? Kelly looked up from his coffee and gave me a hard stare across the kitchen table. I closed my eyes. I wanted sympathy, not a political debate. Actually, no, I don't think that at all, I said. And damn, I sounded querulous. Kelly and I had been mates from childhood, messing around together and propping each other up through life's inevitable traumas. He was funny and loyal and caring, always willing to lend a hand. He was the brother I never had. And yet, at times like this, I didn't actually like him much. We had never been on the same page politically, but in the last 5 years, he'd become a convert to so-called libertarianism and turned starry-eyed by the so-called magic of the market. Whenever he got political these days, he showed a callous streak, and it always came as a shock when I saw it. People have more defensive layers than there are geological strata in the Grand Canyon. Layers cemented together by the anxiety of living in an unnecessarily insecure and unsociable world. It seemed to me that Kelly had grown to be at odds with his own nature. I hadn't intended to call on him that morning. After breakfast, I'd headed into town on foot, on a mission to replace my old and now defunct washing machine. Oh, did I say old? I'd bought it 8 years ago, and I wasn't happy that it had died already. My previous machine had lasted me 35 years with barely a hitch. It was a drizzly Saturday in February, the sort of day that makes you feel bleak inside. Passing the corner shop at the entrance to Kells Road, I remembered that his wife, Margaret, was up in Aberdeen for the week helping her sister care for an elderly father with dementia. Kel would probably be at home on his own. I turned aside and headed downhill towards his house. When he opened the door, he was looking tired. We went through into the kitchen where he'd been working. He swept aside a pile of paperwork on the table and closed his laptop. We sat down. Tax returns? He pulled a face. We drank coffee and talked of personal issues, of music and motorcycles, and eventually of washing machines. I tried to avoid the topic, but you know how it is. It was like suffering a state of general inflammation. The topic emerged as a moan. The moan hardened into a rant, and I was soon well into it. The machine had broken down at a bad time. Only a month earlier, I'd forked out a lot of cash to replace my failed boiler. Now there was this. When it broke down at first, I wasn't too bothered. I called Frank. He came over later that afternoon, wearing the same tool belt he'd had for decades. He pulled the machine out from under the counter, prodded inside for a bit, grunted, and then gave me a sympathetic look. "It's the X," he said. "What's an X?" I said. I had no idea. It turned out to be something small but vital. The crucial detail, however, was that it was sealed inside the drum. That meant the whole drum assembly would have to be replaced as a unit. And that was going to cost me an arm and a leg. It would be more economical just to replace the whole machine. I trusted Frank. He'd been doing jobs for me for decades. He leaned up against the counter with a cup of tea and launched into a well-rehearsed diatribe. 30 years ago, he told me, manufacturers of domestic appliances made available a full range of replacement parts through their own repair people and through independent businesses. These days, once a new model went on sale, replacement parts for the old one became rare as hen's teeth. Not that it often made any difference. In washing machines, it was common practice these days to spot weld the drums, sealing components inside them and making them inaccessible when they failed. Customers were forced to buy new machines while their existing ones were still largely in good working order. Frank looked me straight in the eyes and grimaced. I nodded. I'd heard a depressingly similar story from the gas safe engineer who'd been unable to source parts for my boiler. After I'd shown Frank out, I got online and checked out a number of consumer magazines and independent repair companies. I was soon scribbling away in a notebook. The average life of a washing machine these days is 7 years. Seven! Apart from the expense to the customer, this represented immense wastage of resources and employees' labour when it could have been doing something more useful. Criminal, Frank had called it. Independent maintenance companies were reporting components designed to break down after a certain number of washes, a remarkably small number in some cases. Kel sat listening while I spilled all this out across the table. He looked increasingly sceptical. This was going to result in an argument, but I was too far gone to stop. "Planned obsolescence is everywhere these days," I said. My words worked on him like some kind of dark magic. "Come on, that's left-wing bullshit," he said. He was trying hard to keep his tone moderate, but there was a snarl in his voice. We had hit a familiar impasse. Kel wore free market economic theory like a cloak of invulnerability. I often wondered in these moments how our friendship survived. I gave him a crooked look. "It makes no sense," he said, spreading his hands. "Why would a business do that? Companies aren't stupid. If something ends up being a piece of junk, who's going to buy it again?" He stopped and stared at me. "We've been through this before." "Yes, we have," I sighed. "There's no point pretending it doesn't happen when it plainly does. What about the Phoebus cartel?" "Oh, not that again. Socialists always trot that one out." "Oh, and that means it didn't happen?" "Oh, it only lasted a few years." "Well, that's not true." The doings of the Phoebus cartel are well recorded, and it's an often quoted example of planned obsolescence. In 1925, light bulb manufacturers across America, Europe, and Japan got together and agreed to make bulbs that lasted a maximum of 1,000 hours, despite their having lasted up to 2,500 hours before that time. The cartel was intended to last 30 years, but was forced to break up in 1939 at the onset of war. For a long time after the war, however, manufacturers continued independently to produce bulbs designed to fail after 1,000 hours. Even without the discipline of the cartel, they realised it was both individually and collectively in their interests, and very much against the interests of their customers, to carry on doing this. An individual company might win more customers by doubling the life of its bulbs, but they would sell only half the number that they had before, not just to new customers, but to their existing ones as well. And if one company did it, capitalism being a competitive system, other companies would be forced to follow suit. Kell's idealized formula for how perfectly the market works in the customer's interest failed to represent reality. He scowled at me. "Washing machines don't last as long these days because customers want cheaper products, so that's what they get. What do they expect?" "Well, that's true, but people have limited incomes," I said. "They have always wanted cheaper products, so why weren't they being produced cheaper before? And besides, how does that explain the use of sealed units?" "Washing machines are cheaper today for a variety of reasons, all to do with the profit motive and market economics. Technology has advanced and the costs of manufacture have fallen. The market for white goods has become hotly competitive in recent years, which is driving down prices. And many of the components used are now being outsourced to low-wage economies. In Kale's ideological world, customers control the market. Companies, it is argued, only produce what customers want. It follows, in theory and in Kale's mind, that if washing machines don't last as long as they used to, then it must be the working class consumer's fault for demanding cheaper goods. What a surprise. It is extraordinary that no matter how free market economics theorizes a problem, by some magic it invariably turns out to be working people's fault. Come on, Kel. Major companies have even admitted introducing all kinds of ways to limit their products' lifespan, or making them unrepairable. Apple and Samsung, for instance. Apple and Samsung don't make washing machines, he snapped. I threw up my eyes. It was Kel now who was sounding querulous. We're not just talking about washing machines. Obsolescence is widespread. It's a consequence of the capitalist market system. There have been lawsuits taken out against companies in the EU for it, against Epson, for instance. You're clinging to a theory that justifies your belief in capitalism, but it doesn't represent reality. Competition is built into the system, which means that if one company introduces a degree of planned obsolescence, they all have to. He said nothing, just pulled a face to show how stupid I was to believe anything so irrational. There are multiple ways manufacturers have of manipulating consumer purchases. Back in the day, Henry Ford figured out that by bringing out new models of cars regularly, he could stimulate public desires for novelty and get them to dump their old machines before they needed to. Mobile phone companies do the same today, producing new models every year, often with only minor improvements, or with a new look which gets marketed as the latest must-have item. Newness is sexy. At the same time as new models appear, companies flood the market with adverts extolling their virtues, and people start to notice their existing phones are running unaccountably slow. Owning glitzy new things indicates status. It fills the emotional hole left inside us by the loss of community and closeness. Kale stood up abruptly and left the room. I stared at the rain running down the window pane and sighed. No matter how hard we tried to avoid these confrontations, they kept occurring. It was a couple of minutes before he came back. He stood in the doorway. His frown deepened for a moment, but then he exploded into laughter. I smiled and shook my head. "Sounds tough. Do you need some cash?" he asked. "I'm not badly placed at the moment." I looked down at his tax returns. Even if true, I knew it was a half-truth at best. His work was seasonal. This was not his best time of year. "I'll get by. I'll need to economise for a while. No extras. Right now, though, I need to go and buy this bloody machine or else I shall start to stink." I got up and we walked to the front door. "Give my love to Margaret," I said when we reached the hallway. "When is she due back?" He sighed. "Depends how long she's needed. Her sister's pretty exhausted looking after their dad. He wandered out of the house by himself last week and got lost. They had to call the police." Ouch, I knew that situation from personal experience. He shrugged and then nodded. "It is what it is. We cope." I said goodbye, pulled up my hood and walked down his path into a February drizzle. For a while my head was full of messy thoughts and feelings. Money, property, competition, they screwed up all our relations. Capital value dominated our lives. Kel, though, was a good friend, whatever differences we might have. That was something of real value to hold on to. I pulled myself back to the here and now. The road on either side was lined with a jumble of small businesses, pubs, and tiny Victorian terraces built originally for railway workers. They looked shabby now. I skirted a few gathering puddles, dodged some pedestrians hurrying towards the station, and prepared myself mentally to do battle with sales staff eager for a sales commission.
You have been listening to World Socialist Radio, produced by the Socialist Party of Great Britain. If you would like to find out more, you can visit our website, spgb.net.